Welcome back, everybody, for lap two of the Sideways podcast. Me and Scotty, we appreciate the kind words so much from the first episode. You guys all bared through with the AI artwork that we had to use. We are in the process of getting a pretty cool design, and I'm really looking forward to that. Scotty, I'm glad you came back for week two.
Hey, like you said, lap two, we haven't been black flagged. We're not DQ'd yet. We're still in the hunt. Glad to be back, man. This was a lot of fun. This was really exciting last week. I appreciate everybody's feedback. It's so cool to see the support for this. We're always, you know, I think Colby and I are both a little nervous to sort of put ourselves out there and to get this thing going. But I really appreciate all the comments and feedback that we got from everybody listening. And yeah, hopefully we can just keep growing this and be better on lap two. Colby, how are you doing? How was your weekend?
The weekend was good. I got released last Wednesday. I'm fully weight bearing again, fully walking around. It's a blessing for me and my girlfriend. Now she doesn't have to quite take care of me as much. Now I'm starting to pay back the favors of doing the dishes and all the laundry that she had to do for about 6 weeks. So my life's, you know, I'm really happy. Luckily, it seems like this ankle injury, they did a really good job fixing it. And moving forward, I hope I don't have any lingering effects, but knock on wood right now, I feel like it's going to be a full recovery and I'll be back to running and riding bicycles shortly. I've actually been riding a bicycle a bit, so that's cool.
That's awesome. That's amazing news. Congratulations. I know this was a big blow to you earlier in the year, so this is super exciting to hear. I love hearing that news, man. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so glad, like I said earlier, to do another lap with you around this podcast. I fully underestimated how much work it was actually going to be. You kind of brought up like, hey, man, I'd love to do the podcasting with you, but I won't have a bunch of time to help editing. And I was like, oh, that's no worries, man. I'll take care of it. Well, 13 hours later and some help from you doing Taryn's part, we released episode one. The feedback is so amazing for us. It just, you know, it continues to push me to do another one of these. It's a lot of work. It's way more work than I thought it would ever be. I've heard it was a lot of work and I fully underestimated that. So the kind words, all the messages, that goes a long way with me and Scotty and keeping us to have this podcast moving forward.
Yep. Kind words. And we'll even take criticism. I'm perfectly happy to hear things that you guys think we can improve in areas. Look, we want to make this as good as it can be. So thank you all for everything. And no joke, the editing, whenever I do videos on Flat Track Flashback, the recording part is the fun part. The editing is the time consuming, and then the upload and the anxiety that comes after that is probably, I would say, the most stressful. But it's rewarding in the same time. Like you said, it's a lot of work that goes into it, but it can be very rewarding in the end. And yeah, you just don't let it be overwhelming on you, man.
No, the kind words, I just look back at those when it's about 3 hours into the editing and I take a quick break, maybe grab a soda. Just now that I'm not racing, I can kind of expand the diet a little bit, but let's get right into it. And now for our guest for lap two of the Sideways podcast, we've got the 2013 Grand National Champion, Brad the Bullet Baker. What's been going on, man? How you doing?
Good, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on. It's really cool that you guys are doing this.
Dude, we appreciate you taking time out of your days. When Colby approached me with this, one of the first guests that came to mind, somebody I absolutely wanted to have on, was yourself, Brad. You've been somebody who's always been just an amazing person to be around in the pits. I met you about 10 years ago, almost today, at Mid-America Speedway, right after the Indy Mile, the short track up there, right before MotoGP or during that weekend. And I don't know if you know this, but you're a big reason that got my dad back coming to the tracks and supporting flat track racing. After Will Davis died, it was really difficult for him to find somebody to root for. And you really became that guy for him, just with how cool you had been to us every time we'd come approach you. So yeah, man, like, I'm glad to have you on. This is going to be fun.
Well, thanks a lot, Scotty. That means a lot to me, man. I remember that night, actually. The Mid-America Speedway was a killer short track and always some good vibes there. And yeah, your dad's an awesome dude. I really enjoyed talking with him at the racetrack.
So you got into announcing there for a bit and you were helping the Indian team, and then you were even able to do some sprint car racing. We all know you've been promoting some races in Michigan as well. What else have you been up to in the personal life?
Yeah, you pretty much listed the stuff as far as what I've been doing with racing since my accident. You know, I put on a couple riding schools and things like that, helping out riders just behind the scenes and staying involved in the sport. But, you know, so I guess, yeah, since my accident, obviously my wife and I are married now, girlfriend at the time. Now we're married. So got married, and I guess it was a little over 3 years ago. So that was a big milestone. And then we got our puppy dog, Bristol, a three-year-old chocolate lab. We got her at Lima in 2021, only like 2 weeks before our wedding, which was, I don't know what we were thinking at the time. We already had a bunch on her plate. And pretty cool story with Bristol. So I was helping out, you know, Briar Bronson-Bauman with the Indian team. And Briar Bronson have been good friends of mine ever since we were kids, growing up on the West Coast, you know, and racing each other at the Internationals ever since we were young kids. And Bronson and I were talking, I guess it was like Fort Texas in 2021. And Bronson and Alex had a couple dogs. And, you know, I was like, he was like, when you and Kelsey got to get a dog? And I'm like, well, soon, want a dog. But it's like, man, it's got so much going on during the race season. And Kelsey's schedule with being a nurse and got the wedding coming up. So it's not good timing right now. And it's like, yeah, I understand that. I was like, what type of dog would you want? And so I said, a lab. Like, I grew up with a black lab and I just wanted nothing but a lab. It's like, well, my mom and dad are about to have litter labs. And I'm like, man, it's just not good timing, but that would be so cool to get, you know, a dog from your mom and dad. So fast forward, you know, basically a month, and we get to Lima, and I pull up to Barry and Lisa's camp, and I see the puppies, and I just immediately remember, I'm like, oh, puppies. And they say, hey, Brad, there's one more left. And they, Lisa, man, it's so sad, and gives me goosebumps talking about this now. With Lisa, she was like a mom to all of us at the racetrack and such a sweet lady. But Lisa brought up Bristol and set her in my lap when I was in my car, and I was immediately in love. And yeah, long story short, we took her home that day, and the rest is history now. But Bristol is, she's been our little angel, really. She's an awesome, awesome dog, and both Kelsey and I's best friend. But unfortunately, when she was only 10 months old, she got diagnosed with congenital kidney disease. And once we found that out, that absolutely broke our hearts, because they told us that she could have like a minimum of 2.5 weeks to live. And immediately, you know, me being pretty educated on the body from screwing mine up so much, and Kelsey being a nurse, we sprung into action and came her own advocates and got her on a special holistic diet and give her sub-Q fluids every day. Give her, just poke a needle underneath her neck and give her like 500 milliliters of sub-Q fluids, keep her hydrated more, flush toxins out of her body. So I guess you asked like what I've been doing. It's been long-winded, but a lot of my day consists of taking care of our dog and making food for her. Like, she's a bodybuilder, giving her fluids. She's our child. And so yeah, a lot of my day is taking care of Bristol, but she's more than worth it. And then as of recently, I actually started a new job. Good friend of mine and friends of a lot of ours in the racing community, the Roos Evans family, Joe Roos Evans, father of Aiden Roos Evans. Joe owns a company called FRA Trust. It's a financial management company. He's been in business now for 38 years. So yeah, almost four decades. It's pretty awesome. So he has a lot of experience. I mean, he pretty much has every certification known to man when it comes to estate planning and just pretty much overall financial wealth management. So I've been helping out Aiden ever since he was a young kid. Really, I met him when he was 5 years old, and then he went racing cars for probably when like he was 8 years old until he was like 14. Came back racing dirt track when he was 15, and that was 2019, so it was a year after my accident. And Joe's a smart man, and he's always, you know, he's kind of the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. I mean, he's always grilling people, asking questions. And I mean, he was for a year or two, man, it was pretty much every other day I was getting either a text or a phone call from Joe just asking questions. But they're really good people, and Joe's helped me a lot on, you know, the financial side, just, you know, helping me along with my own personal stuff, and got a set up of trust like 3 years ago, and different financial manager and life insurance policies and things like that. Yeah, I learned a lot from Joe. And then it was earlier this year, and I guess it was even before that, he'd offered me like a job, said, hey man, you ever want to get into, you know, financial management? I'll help you out. I'll show you the ropes. And I'm like, all right. But I was busy, you know, working with AFT at the time in Indiana, and you know, I was still kind of following my dreams of racing, so to speak, you know, even after I was done racing. And then Joe called me, I guess it was probably like February or so this year. He's like, hey man, what, you ever thought about what you're gonna do for a career yet? And I'm like, man, that's pretty much this whole off season. That's really what I was thinking. Like, what am I going to do for my next 30 years, since I just turned 30 and 31 now? But, you know, just all my backup plans for racing before I got hurt required my physical ability. I mean, I had my CDL before I was out of high school and operating equipment, and I'm pretty mechanically inclined. And, you know, so everything I've really done before required my physical ability. So, you know, it was kind of a good opportunity for me to get into an awesome career that I didn't necessarily need to go 4 years college for, and got this opportunity from Joe. So yeah, pretty much been studying and passing different state certifications. And like, I even went to a 8 day class at a university, and I guess it was early June. So I didn't necessarily go to college, but it was like, I stayed in a dorm room for about eight days, and that I never thought I would ever do that. So that was kind of cool. It was like basically taking 4 years of college and only 8 days. It was like eight 12 to 16 hour days. So it was kind of like drinking through a fire hose, but I passed the course at the end of the, or I passed the test at the end of the course. So must have did something right. So yeah, I guess I've been working now for about 4 weeks, and my job title, I guess, would be a trust advisor. So mainly, yeah, doing estate planning for people, helping set up trust. So yeah, that's a lot really what I've been up to.
It's ironic you say that. My dad was literally just talking to me a couple of days ago about setting up a trust account. So I know, Dad, you're going to listen to this. Reach out to Brad.
All right, cool. Yeah, maybe I did a little bit of plug there for myself, a little advertising.
Like you said, just from the beginning, us racers, we're just so resilient. That's what we have to be to succeed, whether it be us starting out and only making $100 a week, barely making main events, to the injuries that we succumb to. So when I saw that your dog Bristol, because that dog was light for you after your injury, and then when I saw that Bristol was sick, it was devastating. But rather than say the normal person where it's just sheer panic and depression, it's us racers, we're so resilient, so we just jump right into action. And you and Kelsey, and now Bristol's, I don't know how long it's been since the diagnosis, but it's great to see that she's still with you and going around to races and car races and everything. And that's pretty cool about you getting to go to university for a few days. You were able to come out of there with a certification, and you did not owe $100,000. So I think you're pretty far ahead of most college students.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah, my certification right there on the wall. I got it to show for. So yeah, it was definitely cool. And it just kind of, you know, it was gratifying doing that. You know, it's like kind of showed that, hey, I can do something more than just race motorcycles or drive truck or operate equipment or work on things. You know, that's stuff I've done ever since I was a child. It was kind of second nature to me. So to take something on that was new and be able to, I won't say I succeeded at yet, because I mean, until I really make an annual paycheck off it, I think that'll be when I can say that I succeeded and making a living doing it. But you know, I've learned things and I've got the certifications to do it now. So yeah, so I feel like it was definitely a big milestone for me. And I got my irons in the fire on a lot of other things too. Like you said, Colby, like us racers, we're resilient. We're gonna figure it out one way or another, whether, you know, if we have to drive to the other end of the country to pick up another motorcycle and back and to make it to another race, or when it comes to injuries, you know, just kind of become our own advocates there. It's like, doctors might tell you one thing, but it's like we basically are looking for second opinions or whatever we can to get ourselves back on a bike as soon as we possibly can. I'm definitely thankful for racing for a lot of that. I mean, a lot of people probably think that racing, we sit on the motorcycle and twist the grip, but it's so much more behind the scenes of what it takes to actually be a successful professional racer. It teaches you a lot of life responsibility and a lot of life lessons for sure.
The amount of days that I've spent doing some form of just grubby work to try to make $100 to get to the race, to hopefully make the next $100 to get home, is, we've all done it. It is nice when you are able to kind of step away from that. But even then, it's still like, if someone offers me $250 to drive an hour out of the way to go get a motorcycle, it's like, it's a done deal. One funny quick story that I want to bring up is, you broke your elbow at Colin Edwards boot camp, and then you ended up going to a guy named Charles Maka. And so there I ended up going there too, and he introduced us to the electricity. So for the fans at home, so when I broke my kneecap, I went to this place to try to get my knee to bend again, because I had surgery and It was a race against the clock. I was still in the championship for the production twins class in 2018 or 19, excuse me. So what we did is they would hook up this machine, the ARP machine, I believe it's called. And
ARP wave.
Yeah, they would take this thing and it's 0 to 100. And the normal person can probably only take maybe 15. So they're cranking this thing and it helps stimulate your muscles and get everything moving again. The amount of pain that it, the only way I can describe it is the first day there, it felt like someone had a nail and they were hammering in between my kneecap. I mean, I was screaming and I'm in this gym with a bunch of NHL players and MLB players and they're all just looking at me like I'm a little sissy. But Brad, tell us about the times that you've messed around with Jake.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you some stories. So yeah. So Charles Maka, I gave him the nickname Shaka Maka because literally this is what, I mean, a lot of people probably use a TENS unit, like a muscle TENS unit. That's basically what it is, but it's like Russian stem. So like Russian stem, like a lot of like the Russian Olympic athletes back in the day would use the same machine basically to build muscle faster. It basically, any muscle in that area, when you're hooked up to this thing, is fired 100%. You put it on your forearm, and there's no moving your arm at all. That thing is completely flexed, like 100%, and it almost makes it feel like your bones are going to crush. Your muscles are that fired so tight. Think of having, a fresh injury like Colby and I had. Like, I literally had basically a complete elbow replacement, and it was only 2 weeks after that the surgery that I went to the Shaka Maka, or Jimmy Wood and Aaron Colton actually went there before you and I had, and the guy that owned the place, they called him the purveyor of pain. So if that says anything. So anyhow, I basically hooked this thing up to where it's on my elbow, and then they put another electrode pad back on my shoulder. That way, like, all the nerve endings through my arm are basically firing at this point. And now he's basically putting one arm like behind my elbow, supporting like say my humerus, and then taking his other arm and just reaping my arm up and down. And like my elbow still, well, straight completely because of how bad I've messed it up. But man, he is just reefing on this thing. And, you know, it's like as much as I can take far as like turning the thing up. And after the first day, I barely had any voice left. I was screaming so damn loud. So it's and I like to think that I'm a pretty tough guy with all the stuff that we've been through. But this thing, I still have one, actually. I have it down in the basement, and we kind of, it's more like a game. We have some friends over or whatever, and get a couple of drinks at us, whatever. And Kelsey goes like, should we bust out the ARP wave? And I'm like, heck yeah, we should bust out the ARP wave. And Jacob Lane is probably the funniest one to hook up to. He does not do good with getting shocked. And I'll have to send you a video of him getting hooked up to this thing for the first time. But I think he only got up to like 15% and he was just screaming and wailing. But yeah, that thing was no joke. But I mean, I was able to make it to Springfield literally 5.5 weeks after surgery is when I rode Springfield Mile in 2014, and that was the year that I had the number one plate, and that would have been my first national riding for Factory Harley. So it was like hell or high water. I wasn't gonna miss this national, and that was kind of like really the main reason for going down there. Was I'd heard great things of him being able to get people back in the sports really quickly. And Jake Holden, who's number 59, American Superbike rider, was the one that hooked me up with him because he lived down there in Arizona and was going to him. But anyhow, yeah, I made it to Springfield, and this is pretty crazy. So like, since my arm wouldn't like straighten completely, just putting my helmet on, I'd had to like bend my helmet, my head down to my arms to get my helmet on. And then like the end of the leathers were like still like chafing on the end of my elbow. And I got two screws that go in directly at the end of my elbow. And the incision was still so fresh that by the end of the day, just from moving my arm between riding and putting my helmet on and off and grabbing tear-offs and stuff, I'd actually opened up that incision and you could see the head of the screw through the end of my elbow. And you can ask Mike after this, you know, he'll vouch for me because he was the one that was like, oh my God, I see a head of a screw. And but I ended up fit that day. And never miss a national, so I guess that you could say it was worth it. But yeah, some of the crazy stuff that we'll do to be able to race motorcycles, right?
Yeah, I had the same thing actually. Mine was before Springfield as well. And I didn't get to, I got enough where I could have my knee at a 90 degree angle. So if the race would have gone on, luckily it rained out both Sunday and Monday. But if the race would have actually gone on, I was going to have to go through the corner sitting like almost on the back of the seat, which, as you can imagine, would not have been optimal at all. But yeah, just like you said, the things that we'll do to get back out there is looking back, you know, it's, it is crazy, but luckily that pain's all gone and I don't want to use that ARP unit ever again.
No, heck, you ever make it up here sometime, we're gonna have to hook you up to it, though. You're not gonna have any choice.
As a self-proclaimed wuss, I'm curious how my level would be on that. If we could get past like 5%, I would be stoked. I just don't want to pee myself.
And well, heck, depends on where we hook it up. Maybe if I make it to Springfield this year, I'll bring it down. Jimmy Woods basically begged me to bring it to the races because he wants to hook people up to it as well. So,
I'll put $50 on it if somebody can take it to 100 for 10 seconds.
that would be for the first time. Shoot,
Oh.
I'd match that for sure.
Talked about animal care, medical technology. Colby, they can't say that we don't have range on this podcast.
No, definitely not.
I want to shift gears a little bit. Obviously, this past weekend could have gone a little bit better, but you've gotten into promoting races recently. And it's cool to see a lot of current and former pros getting involved in that. I was curious, like, what sort of sparked your interest into being a promoter and what sold you on that track in Mount Pleasant, Michigan?
Yeah, definitely, Scotty. It is really cool to see more racers get involved because, I mean, really, if we don't do it, who is going to do it? You know, we're the ones really, keeping the torch lit, so to speak. I mean, unfortunately, guys like Eddie Mulder and Gene Romero and even those guys, God rest his soul, Gene Romero was a great promoter on the West Coast, and then obviously Eddie Mulder with Willow Springs. And there's just a lot of guys that are just gotten old and are no longer doing it, and I don't blame them. But with that out then, what do we really got? So it's definitely awesome to see some more riders and people stepping up promoting races. But I'd say the guy that inspired me the most to want to promote a race was Ronnie Jones. I started to become good friends with RJ actually in 2014. So I've been first year at Factory Harley when I had number one plate, and I stayed with him. He lives in Oklahoma City, and I stayed with him before the Oklahoma City Mile in 2014, and we did a little bit of mountain biking, and that's when he told me about his years of promoting the Oklahoma City Half Mile, and I think he did it for like 8 or 9 years. And I know he won it once, he might have even won it twice, but he said there was sold out crowds like the night that he won it, the first night that he won it was like a sold out crowd, and he won the national. And they're like, man, if that isn't winning, I don't know what is. Like, you win the national that you promote and have a sold out crowd. So that was the one that really inspired me the most. Like, I had a goal for a long time where I wanted to promote a national and win the national. It was really cool, like what Jared and Nicole have been able to do with Lima and now Springfield, and Jared was able to do that at Lima. But I mean, I was only 21 years old at the time. I still had a lot of life to get figured out, just really wasn't in the position to be able to promote a national in those days. And then when I got paralyzed, I was only 25, so I was still pretty young. It was actually a gentleman named Ramey Alice who really sparked up my interest to do it again. And Ramey, rest in peace, Ramey. He was the president of Lucky Thumb Motorcycle Club up here in Michigan, which is the oldest flat track racetrack in the state of Michigan, and really, really close here, like only about 5 minutes from my father-in-law's Mike Stauffer's shop. And actually my wife, her whole family was the one that started this racetrack way back in the day, which is pretty cool. But they hadn't had any half mile races here in Michigan for like 11 years up until when I promoted you know, Baker's Bash at Mount Pleasant in 2022, like the last time that they had had a half mile race on the District 14 schedule. I guess they say Jeff Hires put on Hastings, but it wasn't an AMA District 14 race. So they were trying to get some half miles back on the championship in District 14. So Ramey called me up, I think it was like December of 2021, and said, hey, we just got down with the District 14 meeting, and we were, you know, talking about getting a half mile back on the schedule and really just talking about some promoters that, you know, would be interested in putting out on a half mile, and really nobody could think of anybody. And I thought of you, Brad, and it's like, well, what would you think about putting on a race? And I'm like, well, Ramey, it's like, I've been thinking about it for a long time. And, you know, since you said this, I think, yeah, I'll do it. And I got the perfect racetrack where I'd like to do it at too. And it was a track in Mount Pleasant, Isabella County Fairgrounds. So I'd seen that race the first time in 2017. It was that Steel Shoe National Series that was running in 2017. I forget what her name was, Chrissy Cottrell, or I think whatever her name was.
That was a really big money series there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was supposed to be. There was a couple races where they did pay out, but yeah, like that race in particular, nobody got paid. So like it was a killer race between Henry Wiles and Sammy Halbert, and Sammy was actually riding my father-in-law's XR, and Henry was on a Kawasaki. But yeah, it was a knockdown drag out, like kind of basically live at 2012, like reenactment of Henry and Sammy going at it on a cushion half mile at Lima, you know. And Sammy ended up winning it. Henry got second, and it was your typical deep cushion half mile. But this looked like it had a really cool material. It wasn't like limestone. It was more like a sandy red clay, and super wide, super like loamy smooth, and then. Then another cool thing about like Mount Pleasant is the location is right in the center of the state of Michigan. You got Whole Shot Harley Davidson, Kyle Heller, who owns Whole Shot, and Hot Rod Harley Davidson. He owns the Harley Davidson dealership both in Mount Pleasant and in Muskegon. And he's like really, really good friends with the Johnson family. And then got the Richard family from Lakeside Motorsports, which is only like a half hour away, and they sponsored Henry Wiles for quite a few years, and really big Indian Triumph Polaris dealership right in the center of the state. And then got Wilson Industries right there in town, and that was actually the people that built the Kawasaki that Henry rode at Peoria for all the years, one that was kind of like in a DTX chassis. So they built that bike for them. They're right there in town. And then there's a couple other companies right there in town that all, you know, are dirt track enthusiasts. So, yeah, just being right in the center of the state and having a lot of, you know, of the industry around it, a college town, Sword Eagle Casino is only 5 minutes away. So, yeah, it's just a really nice town and a really nice racetrack. So, but we had our work cut out for us big time, especially the first year that we put on the race there, because it literally sat dormant for 5 years since the race that they ran there last in 2017. So the thing was literally just weeds, grass, and mud holes, basically, you know, and they had base like these 3 foot berms on the inside and the outside of the racetrack, where they had pushed a lot of the material off the track because it was a horse track before man-made track. So it was a lot of sand on top. So it was too deep for bikes. And then they even like built up the berms even more on the inside and outside because they ran a snowmobile race. Actually, I guess they ran a snowmobile race right after the winter of 2017. So they made these berms on the inside and outside so they can flood the racetrack, have it freeze, and then they would race snowmobiles on it in the winter. So obviously having a berm on the outside is not safe. Somebody gets out of control, they're just gonna have to jump. So that we had to knock those down, and knocked the inside one down so people could see through the corners. But luckily there's a guy named John Mogg that's owns a trucking and heavy equipment operation company not too far, and he brings his grader and his dozer out, and a couple farmers bring their tractors out to with like basically it's kind of like the, it's called a sunflower. It's like the what you put the finishing touches on like a field before you plant, but it's basically does the same surface as what the track conditioners at the Springfield Short Track TT would do, but the thing's like twice as wide, so you really only got to make two laps around with this thing, and the racetrack's completely resurfaced. So yeah, just, you know, great racetrack, great location, and just a lot of resources there is kind of the main reason why I chose to do it there.
It's so cool to see with that event, you had such a good turnout, some of the best riders in the nation coming out. I love seeing events like that, and like what Corey does with Winter Throwdown in Hagerstown, and seeing so many top pros come out to support those events. You yourself were pretty frequent at some of those like Steve Nace races and the like Outlaw Short Track stuff as well. For you as a rider, like how important was that for you during your career as far as just, you know, keeping sharp on your skills? And then the second part of that, like how important is it to have like pros at those races for the kids to kind of like race with and look up to, and maybe even get like advice and coaching from?
Yeah, definitely, Scotty. Great question. I mean, it's when I was racing, especially, you know, through like say my rookie year in 2011 through like 2013, I guess when I won the championship, it was like those Steve Nace races and a lot of the Outlaw races. That's like what kept us all going as privateers. I mean, when there wasn't a national, it's like you go to one of these Outlaw races that was, you know, had a $10,000 plus purse, and you know, if you went there and got on the podium or won, you know, you can bring anywhere from $1,500 to $5,000 home on a weekend. That was, you know, fuel money and living money and parts money for the bikes and whatnot to keep us going. So like in 2013, Jamie Nicely, he was a good friend of mine. He was the one that brought me to tires in the United States the first time, ran Micah Racing Services. He created a bunch of awards in 2013, because there wasn't a award ceremony at the end of the year for AFT in 2013. And he gave me the Barnstormer award because it was basically the rider that hit up, you know, as many Outlaw races as they could. And I rarely ever got beat that year. I won a lot of races that year and it made a lot of money doing it. And it was, I mean, if it wasn't really for those Outlaw races, I'm not saying I couldn't have kept going, but it was what helped keep going a lot. And like you said, kept sharp. I think that was a lot of what contributed to me doing so well that year, is that all through the winter, I was racing indoors or going down to California and hitting up short tracks down there. And then any off weekend or night, even nights before nationals, I was, you know, hitting up Outlaw races. And I really think that contributed to a lot of my success in 2013, was just staying on the motorcycle and not just practicing, you know, at the test track, but actually getting on the starting line. There's really no substitution for, you know, being on the starting line and being in a race environment that keeps your skills sharp. So I think that helped out a lot. And then, like you said, with having, you know, top pros at these races, I mean, I know what it meant to me when, you know, a lot of, you know, top pros would show up at tracks like that when I was younger. And, you know, I would be up at the fence studying them. You know, it just taught me a lot just by being able to watch them, because there's such a, you know, there's a big difference between the fast local pro and the fast, you know, and when one of the Grand National guys show up, you know, and especially when you get multiple of them out there and you get to see their racecraft and how they set their, you know, set each other up. And then, you know, then a cool thing about flat track is a lot of us are all really approachable and kids can go up and talk to them and learn a lot just by, you know, seeing what they do in the pit area too. So that's super important. And then, you know, it's really good for a promoter when you have, you know, guys like that show up as well, because they put on a show. And you know, a lot of like what I got a 2 day of that. So the first day is what I really call Baker's Bash. That's like only has six classes, three amateur classes, an open expert, a speedway class, and hooligans. So it's you know, I didn't want to like advertise to the fans and get, you know, 1500, 2000, you know, fans there, and then have them have to sit through 8 hours of, you know, 50s and vintage riders and mad dog classes and just bore them half to death. So I, you know, just put, you know, six really good entertaining classes and then put up a decent amount of money for them, you know, a $10,000 purse for the open expert, and then $1,500 from Roost Systems for the Dash for Cash. Then we had $500 whole shot award from Tommy Duma, Tommy Duma Fine Jewelers, and then $500 whole shot or full position award, $500 hard charger award. Oh, and then like Motion Pro threw in a bunch of prizes, Saddleman threw in prizes, Fly Racing threw in some prizes, just, you know, gave, you know, a lot of stuff to the amateurs as well, and just really just tried to give back to the racers as much as I could on that day. And even though I knew I wasn't really going to make anything or much off the racers, I was more banking on, you know, advertising and getting a good crowd there and making the money more off of, you know, the front gate, not the back gate, so to speak, you know. And then Sunday is like a full District 14 race, so it has, you know, all the classes, and then pros and everybody can ride on Sunday as well. But yeah, just kind of wanted to have a weekend that, you know, was giving back to the riders, but kind of pertained to everybody, you know.
Back like 10 years ago, like you were talking about, back in 2013 and 14, at those Steve Nace races, which those were so alive back then. We had, so nowadays there's just a pro class, where back then we had pro singles and pro twins, or expert twins, I guess it would be, or pro expert singles and expert twins. So we wouldn't, if we both went to the same race, I wouldn't even race against you because there was that many people there. And so it was like a mini Grand National at some of these events, where, you know, once in a while you get there and you might just have you and Jared, where other times you've got the top eight guys from the Grand National class there. That was really cool. And we were able to grind our teeth there. And just like you said, I was able to make a little bit of money to carry on. My first ever professional-ish win, I guess, was a Steve Nace race. And I made $570, right? Here in Peoria, actually, where I live right now. And I thought I was rich then. Dad let me keep it all. So for a while there, I was kind of balling out. But that was such a unique time in our sport, where there was just so many professional riders going through the ranks. And being able to, like I said, grind our teeth, that helped me formulate the racer that I ended up becoming. I want to switch gears a little bit here. And this is what I would have liked to hear when I was 16, 17, 18. I'd like to get a little bit of advice from you about what you would do coming up, you know, as a 12-year-old kid moving forward, in what you would have done differently, and any advice. I think I'll start with, you kids that are making, you know, a decent chunk of money right now, get a Roth IRA, max that thing out for like, if you're 19 or 20 years old and you max out your Roth IRA for 2 or 3 years, when you're 50 or 60 years old, you are going to be so happy with yourself. I'm only 27 now, but those 7 years that I missed from 20 to 27, that's going to really affect it. There's this thing called time value of money that I learned about in college, and it's astronomical. I know it's a little bit way off the topic of racing, but you young kids, do look into it and set it up. You'll be so happy with yourselves in 40 years. So Brad, what would you change if you could go back?
That's great advice, Colby. I mean, I wish I would have done the same thing. I mean, the last 10 years of my life, you know, or everything that I've learned from Joe now, like, I wish I would have done exactly what you just said. So that was awesome advice. Kids, definitely listen to what Colby just said, because like you said, yourself at 56 years old will definitely be thanking that, or thanking yourself. And definitely wish I would have been a little wiser with my finances when I was younger. I wasn't completely stupid, but definitely could have been better. But one thing I wish I would have taken more seriously when I was younger too was this my fitness, you know, a little more was, you know, I wasn't, you know, I did a decent amount of training, and a lot of my training was mainly on the motorcycle. I mean, I was always racing, always riding, and I think that's what, you know, really, you know, kept me in good shape, and maybe not being in, you know, marathon type shape, but I was, you know, in good riding shape. But, you know, as I got older and as I started to get more injuries, that's when, you know, physical, you know, training and getting my fitness better, you know, was really, really important. And that was something that I was really focusing on, you know, my last year before I, you know, got hurt, was both my nutrition and my training. And, you know, I'll admit there was some races that I had lost because the last, you know, five laps of the national, I was, you know, slowing down because I got tired. And, you know, really, you know, if you're going to do this for a living, and, you know, it's like, that really should never be an excuse. It's because you got tired. And if it is, that means you've got some work to do. You should, you know, whether your job is to be an athlete and to be a racer, and you should be able to ride just as hard on lap 25 or lap 30, whatever it is now, as what you were on lap two. It was a pretty tall order for me because of how aggressive that I rode. Like, for me to have that much energy at the end of the race to ride as hard as I did at the beginning wasn't an easy thing to do. But, you know, there was times in my career where I definitely was, you know, in good shape. Like 2015, I feel like the year that I won Lima and Indy, I was feeling really good those years, and I was putting a lot into it as well. But, you know, I guess, yeah, I would definitely would have, if I was able to go back, I would definitely would have, focused more on my fitness and nutrition at a younger age. You know, and then really, I guess, I think those two would probably be the number ones. You hit it. It was just, you know, being a little bit more smarter with my money. There was actually a guy who was Chris Carr's financial advisor, and he would come to Hagerstown every year, and he gave me his card. I think it was like 2011, 2012, and he's like, just give me a ring, man. You give me, I forget what, how, I think he told me, it's like, you give me $50,000, and by the time, you know, you're 40 years old, you'll never have to work a day in your life. And I wish I would have listened to that guy back then, because, you know, being, Chris is a super smart racer, and you know, I'm sure Chris is doing pretty good for himself. So yeah, I think those would be the two things. But just enjoy, though. Like, I mean, I say all this, and I mean, I feel like a lot of my success also is because I didn't put, I mean, I wouldn't say I didn't put a ton of pressure on myself, because I definitely did. I mean, I was my own worst critic, and nobody ever had to be hard on me because I was already too hard on myself as it was. You know, I definitely had a lot of fun. You know, I never took it so seriously that I really sucked the fun out of it, you know? So, I feel like if you, you know, start taking it so seriously that it's no longer fun, it makes you go slower on the racetrack. You know, like Kevin Atherton was my race mentor from, say, my rookie year 2011, when I hooked up with the Lloyd brothers, and then until 2013, when I won the championship, when his dad Dave was building my XRs, and you know, Tony Dodge brothers, they were their bikes. But you know, like Kevin always would say, "Hey man, you're having fun, you're going fast." And you know, Kevin was probably king at having fun, maybe had a little too much fun, but you know, there was a good balance in there. You know, it's like, where, you know, you say you work hard, you play hard, and I mean, even MotoGP riders, man, it's like they're at after parties on Sunday. You know, they got a big party on Sunday after the GP, and you know, you'll see Valentino Rossi and Marc Marquez and pretty much all of them there. They're having fun, but they're, you know, they're back they're back on the grind Monday morning or whenever they get home, you know? So it's like, basically just have a good balance of it to where it's like, yeah, it's a job. You got to take it serious, but don't take it so serious that it's no longer fun, because, you know, it's, I think that you'll burn yourself out way too quick if you end up taking it too serious and not having fun with it.
I'm just like you said, I wish I would have been a little bit more responsible with some of my money and saved a little bit more, but I have no regrets for memories. You know, memories last forever, where money can come and go. You work harder and you'll be able to make more money. But the other point you made about the fitness, I'm pretty open now with saying that I don't think I would have broken my back and my ankle in 2022 on the Harley if I would have been more fit. I kind of rushed back to racing. I wasn't able to start working out again until February. And then that race in April, my tongue was dragging about five laps to go, and Nick Armstrong was starting to crawl up on my back tire. And I needed to get third place. That was good money from Harley, and that put me into the Twins main event to make at least another $1,000. So I was pushing really hard, and I was starting to crawl up on Zabala for potentially second place. And I hit that hole. It popped me out of my seat. And had I been stronger, I think I probably would have been able to save it, but I know I was tired. So you can't get talent. Talent's something you're born with. You can get skills working really hard on the bike and gain skills and speed through, you know, practice and all that. But you can do the work off the bike. There's no reason you should ever go to a race where you're not fit. And in the singles class, you can kind of get away with it once in a while. The races aren't as long. But nowadays, it seems like the pace that they're running is so high from right off the bat where you can't get away with it, because you'll lose your breath and those front three guys will be gone. Where as soon as you get to the Twins class, you better be strong. Another question I had is, you broke your elbow in 2015. Did you have any significant injuries before that? And then after you broke your elbow, do you think that had a change on your career?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so I actually broke it the first time in 2014. So it was like April, it was my dad's birthday, April 15th, 2014. I broke it for the first time. And then we'd already talked about my 5.5 week, rehab session after that. And then I pretty much just went directly in the racing after that. And what you hit on, like, not coming back so fast and making sure that you're 100% healthy before you get back on the bike, is that's probably, if I was to go back, and I say this, like, if I was to go back, like, Harley never put any pressure on me. Like, Chris Kuhnhauer said, hey, Brad, if you got to take off Springfield. You got as much time as you need to get yourself healthy. And it was more of me putting pressure on myself, because it was number one plate. I wanted to, defend the number one plate. I wanted to ride for, I wanted to ride the Springfield Mile on the factory Harley. So, it was, and a lot of us, it's like, it's our livelihood. So we feel like we're kind of got a gun to our head saying, you got to get back on the bike because you got to make money or you got to, results. And, whereas you watch like motocross, supercross, like look at Ken Roczen and Cooper Webb and Eli Tomac right now, those guys, when they get hurt, they stop. They take the time and do the rehab and do the training to get themselves back 100%, because we all know that supercross, motocross is the most physically demanding sport in the world. And those guys know that there's no reason to come back unless they're 100%, because they're either going to get hurt again or they're not going to be able to win unless they're 100%. Whereas, like you said, Colby, now it's like the pace is so high and the races are longer. Like, heck, a lot, we used to have 25 lap nationals, and now some of these nationals are, I think Ventura was like 42 laps or something. Like, that's a ton of laps on a short track and in an aggressive, and a track that you can ride really, really hard too. So yeah, I would definitely recommend riders to take the time to get themselves back 100% before they get back on a bike, because like you said about your accident in Kansas or Missouri, you might have been able to hold on to it if you were, in better shape or back to 100%. And even my injury, you know, at the X Games in Minneapolis, when I became paralyzed, you know, my left elbow, I broke it the second time at the Super Prestigio at the end of 2014. So I broke it the first time in April in 2014. And then in the last qualifying session at the Super Prestigio in December of 2014, I cooked a hole and I went over the high side and I landed with my arm completely extended above my head, and my elbow was the first thing that got hit. And basically, like, I hyperextended my shoulder and I basically yanked my shoulder out of the socket. So when that thing hyperextended, like, the top ball of my humerus, like, hit the socket of the shoulder, inner socket of the shoulder, broke the head of the humerus and tore a bunch of ligaments in my shoulder. And then I was basically in a sling for 5 weeks, letting my shoulder heal. So I wasn't really moving my elbow at all. And like 5-6 weeks after, you know, that accident, you know, letting my shoulder heal up enough to where I could get into physical therapy, I would be on an arm bike and I'd be cycling, and I could just, my elbow was like a click, a click, a click. And long story short, I ended up breaking the prosthetic. I got a prosthetic radial head in my left elbow, and I broke the prosthetic. So I ended up having to get a full revision, went back down to Houston and seen Dr. Henry Small, good friend of mine, awesome orthopedic, and had to have a full revision done on my elbow again. And then that was this January 26th. It was the end of January. So not long before Daytona. I mean, Daytona is the beginning of March, and we're starting another championship in 2015. So, like, there I am again, rushing back into it. I mean, I was like, I basically wrote off Daytona. I'm like, there's no way I'm going to be able to ride Daytona. And I was running some practice, like, ride days at my house, at my track in Washington where I grew up. And I had, like, oh, like Scooter Vernon, my brother, Hunter Taylor, Tanner Dean, a bunch of guys were there, you know, riding, training, getting ready to go for Daytona. And I was riding my pit bike around my 50, and I was able to ride wheelies and still able to, you know, drive the water truck and stuff. So I was doing stuff with my arm. And then finally Scooter was like, man, it's like, how about you suit up and just see how you can ride? And I was like, finally I was like, okay, all right. And by like the third lap, like, I'm already getting it. I mean, this is a track that I grew up on, you know, I can ride it like with my eyes closed, you know. So I'm getting around pretty good, and I made it like five laps and I pulled off, and I'm like, man, I feel pretty good. and so I rode some more, and then that was when I was like, all right, I think I can go to Daytona and I can at least make the main event and collect points and at least start off my year to where I'm not, you know, 0 points, you know? So I did it. I went to Daytona, and heck, the first day I actually set fast time, which was, you know how Daytona is, slippery little one notch groove. So it was probably maybe a good thing that I was riding a little bit mellow, but made both main events and collected points. And then we had, like, that was when it was like a big break between Daytona and the next race would be Memorial Day, Springfield, you know, end of May. So I basically had another 2 months to get myself healthy. And I did, I came back healthy for Springfield, and I ended up getting third. But, you know, I guess long winded here, you know, how you said, like, it affect my career. Like, yeah, it definitely did affect my career. I mean, my elbow was, my arm's still not the same. I mean, it still gives me a lot of pain, makes terrible racket when I move it, doesn't, you know, extend or rotate all the way. You know, and even in the accident and at the X Games, like, the way that bike hooked up so fast and wheelied and then set the front end back down so violently, basically when the front end came back down, it basically, like, buckled my arms and I went over the, you know, basically went over the front end, and I was essentially like surfing on the crossbar pad. But, you know, like, who's to say, you know, if I was stronger, if, you know, if it wouldn't have bucked me off. But I guess, you know, I'm still pretty strong, I'd say. I mean, for it being as bad as it is, like, I'd arm wrestle a lot of people with it still. But
yeah, if you guys next time you see Brad, go up and shake his hand just to get a notification of how strong he is. He will squeeze that bad boy.
Yeah, so it's I think, I mean, obviously that's what all I got to use now is my arms. So wheeling the wheelchair around and doing transfers and I still do a decent amount of exercise here at home. You know, I got a pretty good little workout room down in the basement. So, but that elbow, man, it's like, it was something that I knew was going to be hard for me to really run out my career. You know, if I was going to have like be able to retire at, you know, 40 years old, that I was really going to have to focus on that elbow and keep it strong and keep it healthy, because it wouldn't be able to go through much more if I damaged it again. I mean, it's essentially maybe not as bad as Ken Roczen's, but pretty damn close.
Yeah, it's like when we get injured, it is like immediately we want to go back to racing. We're not getting a paycheck. At that moment, it's like the only thing that matters to us, where just like you said, looking back now, take the extra time, take the extra couple of weeks, get back to your fitness. It in the long run, you're going to be glad you did. There is situations where you don't really, you know, have the choice, kind of like when it comes to you being contending for a championship, and you do have to take those calculated risks. But even in those situations, if you do get tired, just, you know, back off a little bit. I've got a bit of a hot take question that I've been talking about with a few of my friends throughout the years. So with the new rule book, obviously the Indian is done, the greatest flat track bike to ever exist. There's a few guys that have decided to ride the Indian, whereas they could be learning their skills on a production twin. This is their first year in the twins class with Declan Bender and Trevor Bruner. Trevor started out the year on the KTM, and now they've switched full-time to the Indian. And then Declan, Johnny Goode's got a lot of Kawasaki's, but Declan's been racing the Indian. What is your opinion on them spending the time on the Indian rather than starting to build the notebook and have to going from a bike that is so amazingly smooth to have to relearn a parallel twin next year? I mean, you know how different it is. It's a very different motorcycle. You have to ride it very differently. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's a good question, Colby. I mean, I understand why they're riding the FTR. I mean, obviously they want to ride whatever they think they can, you know, get the best results on. And, you know, maybe they're giving up a little bit now, you know, riding that bike, you know, rather than focusing on developing, you know, a production bike or getting used to a production bike. But at the same time, you know, when you're first starting out, the last thing you want to do is get discouraged or feel like it's, you know, you're the one that's, you know, basically the reason why you're getting poor results. So I think maybe starting out on, you know, a good motorcycle at least kind of eliminates that one, you know, common denominator that, hey, the bike I know is capable of winning races. So now I just got to focus on myself rather than focusing on learning a twin and, you know, trying to develop a twin at the same time. So, you know, I guess you could say it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, you know, and just, you know, take Breyer Bauman for instance, you know, like Breyer started developing a KTM with Dave Zanotti last year after he had just gone off of, you know, I guess he would have been riding it for 4 years, 2019, but yeah, for 4 years. So he, you know, won two championships almost won four. I mean, he was, you know, in contention for all four of them. And, you know, he, in 23, I guess, would have been the year that, you know, Factory Indian was kind of scaling back, pulling away from the sport, putting more of the baggers program. But, you know, Breyer could have stayed on an Indian. He could have stayed the same, you know, program that he had, you know, with Sanavi and Michelle and SNS, and Indian would have let him keep the bikes that he was riding. He just went and had, like, you know, the budget and, you know, maybe not as big of a salary and stuff as what he had before, but he could have stayed on bikes that he knew that were capable of winning. But, you know, he wanted to get a head start on developing a production bike because, you know, we basically knew that, you know, AFT had inferred that that was the way that things were most likely going to go in the future. But, you know, you see what Breyer's done the last 2 years. I mean, he's done great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, for what they were able to do, especially last year, their first year on that motorcycle of, you know, getting on the podium and winning two races, especially winning Springfield at the end of the year on essentially a stock engine was awesome. But, you know, he hasn't been in the contention for the championship the last 2 years because of that motorcycle. So, you know, like, he kind of basically sacrificed 2 years of his career that he could have been in contention to win championships to develop a motorcycle where, you know, it's only guess time will tell if it pays off, but it's kind of like, that's a real hard decision to make where it's like, do I sacrifice now and my results and, you know, win in a championship, or should I just, you know, ride this thing out until, you know, I can't anymore and then cross that bridge when that time comes, you know? It's, like I said, that's a hard decision to make, but, you know, especially for a guy like Breyer, like I said, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that if he was on an Indian the last 2 years, that he would have been contending for a championship with both Dallas and Jared. But, you know, since that bike, even with as good as it was early on and its development stages, it's still not there. So yeah, I guess that's long winded and I got a little bit off the subject and gone to Breyer, but, that's a hard call to make for sure.
No, I think that's a good connection because Breyer's an absolute dog. He's an amazing, very extremely talented flat track racer. And you said it really good with Breyer. You know, he sacrificed, not fully because he's out there and he's still getting race wins, but he kind of sacrificed 2 years of his career to develop this KTM looking to the future, starting with 2025 and beyond, where had he been on the Indian for the past two seasons, he would have been contending for a championship. He wouldn't have the salary or the parts budget as he would have had earlier on. But imagine this year. I mean, we could say if, but if Breyer would have been on an Indian this year, look how close he is on the KTM. And there was times throughout this season where Breyer's back there with me on the racetrack. I'm like, buddy, you should not be back here right now. So it, like, I mean, there's times where it works out amazingly and there's times where it's like, you are not, this is not where you should be finishing. So in another idea, kind of back to what I originally was saying with Declan and Trevor, you made a good point with saying, you know, it's hard to decide what to do, but a positive that I just thought of is being able to race that Indian now is giving Declan and Trevor the experience of racing in the front of the twins class. So that, I mean, the value of that, learning to go into the corners on the mile and the draft, learning to be able to trust your front end going to a half mile corner really tight with all the other twins guys, that's invaluable experience. And had they been on a, you know, developing those production twins engines this year, they may not have been able to get all that experience throughout the year. So they're building their memory bank and their personal notebook, their riding notebook moving forward. So it is a double-edged sword. You are giving up a little bit in the future to gain now, but we'll just have to see what happens. They're both learning so much. So it'll be interesting to see how those two adapt to the KTM and potentially the Kawasaki.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like, I mean, like, say, like, my rookie year, I rode the Ducati, you know, for the Lloyd brothers, a 1200 hypermotard, you know, engine that was in, you know, the Lloyd brothers chassis. And And that was a pretty good bike. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, David and Mike Lloyd were are smart guys, and you know, for that being kind of like the earlier years of building production motorcycles, like it was a good bike. I mean, especially when there's traction. Like there's traction, and that kind of seems like any production motorcycle. Like when you got something to get a hold of, you know, pretty much all the production motorcycles are fairly decent, but you know, that motorcycle had its problems though, especially like on tracks where it got really hooked up and then it started to flex and do weird things. Like at Springfield, I used to call it the snake. The thing would slither down the straightaway, you know, and just be in like a full on head shake by the end of the straightaway, but it would start in like a full like bike, you know, like rear end waller, and then end up into like a head shake by the end of the straightaway. And you know, it had a lot of horsepower. I mean, that was like the only twin that I've been able to come off, you know, come off the corner on a half mile, be spinning, and then be able to like lean back, hook up, pull back, and be able to just ride a wheelie all the way down the straightaway. And like, it was super fun. Like, there's no way I was ever going to do that on an XR750. The thing never had enough horsepower to do it. But I hopped on an XR at the end of 2011. I rode one at Castle Rock, because they had like a big money race the night before the Castle Rock TT on the quarter mile, and I rode that XR up on the picture here in the office. It's a 1978 Mert Lawwell chassis XR, and a good friend of mine, Roger Lambert, let me ride it for the first time when I was only 14 years old. But then I rode it again at the, you know, halfway through the season, and I hopped on that bike and I made it that first practice. And I'm like, I'd rather ride this thing than that Ducati for the rest of the year. I mean, and it was just an old, like I said, 78 XR750 with a dual shock Lawwell chassis. And then I hopped on the Dodge Brothers XR at Willow Springs at the end of the year, and I won by a straightaway. I was just so, like, after hopping on a bike that was very difficult to ride at some places, when I finally hopped on a bike that was what it was really supposed to do, it was like, yeah, hopping in a Cadillac basically, you know. And you know, and Briar and I have actually talked about it quite a bit, because like his rookie year, he rode an SV1000, and that thing was pretty much the same thing as the Ducati, you know, just a handful, a lot of horsepower. But you know, it kind of developed him into the rider that he was, and also helped him, you know, be able to adapt and ride different things. And I think that's why you can ride the KTM so good now. Is not, you know, I'm not saying that it's not a good motorcycle, obviously it's decent, but he's the only one that's doing that on a KTM. You know, his brother is a really good rider, but he's not doing that on a KTM. And I think it has a lot to do with Breyer's background of riding the SV and riding some poorly built Kawasaki's in his day, and just, you know, made him a very versatile rider. And just kind of like how I started out on the Ducati, you know, there's, I guess, two ways to think about it, you know?
Yeah. I love your insight and your ability to sort of assess like how different guys are able to adapt to different machines and whatnot. I guess that's probably what made you so good in the booth. Like we kind of miss you on those broadcasts. What was it like being in the booth versus, you know, sort of the racer or like even the rider coaching stuff that you were doing? What was a typical production day like for you?
Well, thanks, Scotty. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of second nature for Scotty and I. I mean, you know, I say this in the most humble way possible, but I got a lot of practice with him from 2009 until, you know, the time that I you know, crashed, or my career ended, because I was, you know, either winning races or leading championship points, and just got to talk on the microphone a lot, you know, and was You know, I feel like I was always pretty decent on the microphone, even going back to the amateur nationals back in the day, you know. But yeah, just being able to talk on the mic with Scotty, and then just him being a good friend and being comfortable with him, I think yeah, just kind of made it a natural fit. And then just being able to explain things kind of more in layman's terms, you know, it's like, you got to be able to bring good insight, but don't speak like, you know, you're talking to, you know, not too much racer talk. You got to be able to say it in a way that everybody will be able to understand. And that was something that I really felt like I did pretty good. And something that was awesome for all the fans was just to be able to bring that insight, but not to make it too technical that we're not everybody be able to understand. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was cool. I mean, you know, it kept me a part of the show. You know, it was definitely was hard, you know, being at the races and no longer racing, especially when, you know, like watching the singles class wasn't nearly as hard because those were all a bunch of young kids that I help, you know, and there weren't really my competitors. But like watching the twins class, you know, watching Jared and Briar, you know, like, you know, the guys that I, you know, would be battling with every single weekend, like that was tough. But, you know, being there, being a part of the Indian team, you know, helping out Briar and Bronson, being a, you know, a small part of their success, and then, you know, being up in the booth and still being a part of the show, you know, kind of helped me transition, you know, those first couple years from, you know, not being able to race anymore to, you know, my role, you know, in the sport after that. And on, I've been talking, you know, like I talked with Mike Hacker and Johnny Murphy and Willie McCoy and, you know, you name it, all the rest of the riders that, you know, Kenny Coolbeth, you know, all the riders that have been able had to retire. I mean, it's kind of the same, you know, Colby, you're probably going through it right now. I mean, it's, you know, when it really sinks in that you're no longer a racer, you know, I mean, we're always going to be a racer, always a racer at heart, but you're not, you know, actually throwing on the steel shoe and putting on the helmet anymore. It's a weird feeling, and it's kind of hard to find your place, you know, afterwards. So if you keep busy and you stay involved and you give, you know, have a purpose at the racetrack, like I don't, that's kind of a reason why I haven't been going this year, is like I don't have a job. Like I don't just go to the races. Like I'll go to a local race or something, you know, and just go to hang out and you know, and then I'll always help kids or do something, you know, but I don't really think I can just go to a Grand National and just go there to be a spectator. You know, I gotta have a job. I gotta be doing something, or I gotta have a purpose there. It's kinda like going to work for free, basically, you know. So that was what was really good about, you know, commentating and being a part of the Indy Motorcycle Racing team. You know, it just but yeah, the commentary was really cool. I think, you know, nothing against, you know, the guys in the booth now, but you know, it's what they're missing. It's like, you know, Colby, you've done a really good job the couple of times you've been able to jump on, and you know, you give really good insight like I do, and say it in a way that everybody can understand. And you know, I really think they're missing the boat big time, because you think of not just motorsports, but any sports period. I mean, you got a past athlete or a past racer, you know, they're giving that technical insight, and it's an interesting factor that they're missing right now, for sure.
I appreciate your compliment there, and it is very difficult to go into the booth and commentate and do it well, like Brad was able to do. And he said it perfectly, how Brad's technical knowledge is way beyond what I know and what I can remember and try to speak about. But Brad was able to articulate it to you fans that maybe, you know, it's their first time ever watching a race, or they've been doing it for 10 years. But he was able to break it down into a way in layman's terms for anyone to be able to understand it. And that allows you to get a deeper connection to the race and learning about it, and that makes you more passionate about it in the end.
Yeah, just one last thing, and you touched on the Super Prestigio stuff. You're one of the riders who's gotten to go overseas and compete in Spain with Marquez. Do you still have a relationship or any interaction with him at all?
You know, I haven't spoke to Mark in a while. You know, like, I mean, I actually have more of a relationship with some of the team members on Marquez's team, on his HRC, you know, Honda team, than I do with Marquez. Like, I you know, I'll comment on his, you know, Instagram story or something like that, you know, and he'll reply back, you know, regards mate or thumbs up or, you know, whatever, you know, but I haven't really, you know, spoke with him in a while, but now I keep tabs on, you know, pretty much a lot of MotoGP because one of my best friends is Ferran Cardús, and Ferran and his brother Ricky are really good friends with a lot of the GP guys. I mean, they run a racetrack called Rocco's Ranch, which is at Circuit de Catalunya, you know, the GP track in Barcelona, which is the same racetrack that Kenny Roberts ran his dirt track riding ranch back in the 90s. That's the same track that Rocco's Ranch is. So, you know, basically during the winter, you know, you got the Espargaró brothers, you know, Jorge Martin, Jack Miller, Joan Mir, you know, pretty much you name it, all the riders are there, you know, during the winter. So yeah, I pretty much, you know, I've got a pretty good tie with what's going on in MotoGP with Ferran. But you know, I'd probably keep more in touch with Valentino Rossi. Like Valentino, I don't want to say that he's better than Marquez, but he's a little bit more down to earth and a more of an approachable guy, you say, than Marquez, you know, and that's really just kind of why he's the people's champ, you know. Like, heck, after I got hurt, you know, Valentino sent me two of his helmets, you know, and one to be able to raffle off and one to have in my own collection. And you know, and after I got hurt, I can message, you know, send Valentino a text and he'll text me back, you know. It's like, that's you know. And then whereas Mark, he's a good dude, but definitely not as approachable, I would say, as Valentino is.
And with that experience overseas, and motorcycling is huge in Spain. I mean, we see it with all throughout Europe. I'm a massive Speedway GP fan for the past few years. Like, following that has been insane this past few
years. Here, it's badass, yeah.
Right? And so being over there and seeing, like, how motorcycling is received over in Europe, so what was sort of, like, your biggest takeaways from that versus how we have it here in the States?
Man, it was a surreal experience for me. I mean, especially when I went over for the Super Prestigio, because I was like racing against Marquez, and they played me up to be, you know, like, I'm Marquez's arch rival, you know. So like, you know, I was like, Marquez is like their superstar. So like, if they're playing me be up to be, you know, like Marquez or the rider to beat Marquez, it was, you know, these people were, you know, kind of idolizing me, and it was in a different way than what we get, you know, our fans here. Like, here in America, we got awesome fans, don't get me wrong, but they just know me as, you know, Brad Baker, the guy that puts his legs on, you know, my pants on one leg at a time, you know. Whereas over there, it's like they act like you walk on water. And that just I'd really never had fans hang out at the gate outside the racetrack and wait until, you know, we had all, you know, came out of the race, you know, that we're just getting to leave to be able to get an autograph. Like, it was like the last Super Prestigio, and there's literally kids waiting outside the gate of the racetrack for me to get an autograph. And I'm like, that don't happen here in America, you know. And they just, but they just love motorcycles, man. It's like they there's in Barcelona, Spain, there's more bikes riding on an average day in Barcelona than there are at like Daytona Bike Week. I swear, it's like you go to the damn stoplight in Barcelona and it's like a damn starting line. It's like as many damn scooters as you can fit in this lane, they're there, and they're all the way from, you know, basically young girls with book bags to old ladies to you name it. They're all riding motorcycles, you know, and they're just they're just fanatics. You know, and like going to Valentino's ranch in 2016, like that was an awesome experience as well. But it was just I think it was like a Wednesday or a Thursday that we rode at his ranch. And just on an average day, there would just be people hanging out at the main gate for the ranch, just hoping that he's going to show up that day. You know, and this, they don't know that he's coming. They're just hoping that he's going to come, you know? And it's just a different culture, and but it's super awesome. Like I really, really enjoyed my time in Spain. And like I said, like Ferran is like one of my best friends, and I got a couple other friends in Spain that are like family of mine too, and they're just a really awesome, friendly, fun culture of people, that's for sure.
And we've got such amazing fans here in the United States, where after the races, it's kind of like, you know, maybe you could just sit around and have a drink with them. Whereas the way you make it sound over in Europe, it's like if you offered that to one of them, they would just pass out. So
yeah, exactly. They'd be like, "Whoa, oh, what? Nah, that don't happen." You know.
I wish I would have had the chance to experience that. That's cool. I wish one day that could be, you know, flat track here. It's almost like Supercross here, but I think. It sounds like it's way beyond what Supercross is here, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's I'd say Supercross is pretty close to it. Like you see the, you know, the kids that idolize, you know, the riders there, you know, there, but here for Supercross. But man, I feel like it's even more so there. Like you go to I went to Valencia, the season finale for MotoGP in 2016, and that was just a surreal experience. I mean, just so many dang people, and they're just crazy for it, man. It's like it was definitely different than going to a Supercross or an outdoor national here. The people are just ecstatic. Like it was just probably the most electric atmosphere I've ever been in before was a European GP. So you guys should definitely try to put that on your bucket list sometime. It doesn't matter what country you're in, but just I think especially Spain. Like I think Spain and even the season finale, I think that's what really made it what it was. But it was a super cool experience.
I just bought a JD Beach shirt from Titleist Cycle, and they've got a raffle going on where one person will get a two-person all-expenses-paid trip to Jerez for the World Superbike race. So maybe I will be able to win that, and then I'll be able to experience it. But, Brad, I'm so glad and thankful that you took the time out of your night to come on here and chat with me and Scotty. And I think all the fans will really appreciate hearing from you and hearing some of these stories that they, you know, never heard before. And, yeah, I'm excited to edit this one up and get it out to all the people.
Well, thanks. Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it. And Colby, I haven't really talked with you since, you know, you announced your retirement, man. But I think you made a hard and but very smart decision. And you had a great career, man. And I wish you all the best in your future. But I'm sorry that you didn't get to end the season that you wish that you probably would have been able to end it off like like you would like to, but you've had an awesome career. This is awesome. You guys are doing this, and I wish you guys both nothing but the best.
Legend, dude, that was incredible. I mean, the stuff that Brad's able to give you and to recall so much from his career, and even all the ventures that he's taken on outside of racing. You know, I kind of touched on it earlier, but you know, about just his trades and like all the stuff that he's been involved with financing and promotion and broadcasting. I mean, just a real jack of all trades. We touched on so much with that. That was incredible stuff.
I just didn't even want to cut in ever. I just wanted to keep, hearing the stories because some of the stuff I knew, but he had so much insight and so many more things to tell us. And I learned a lot. I liked having the little joking scenario there about that ARP wave. I really wish that I could have, I wish I had a video of me and him going through that. That was one heck of an experience. But yeah, no, that was amazing getting Brad on. And he's definitely missed not seeing him at the racetrack anymore. One of the most personable and friendly guys ever. Anybody could go up to Brad and you're not going to be there for 1 minute talking to him. You're going to be there for 10. He's going to tell you a story. He's going to invite you in. You're going to act like you're going to feel like you knew Brad for the last 10 years. So glad to get him on and be able to catch up. And I'm really glad that he's able to get that finance deal going. And hopefully that's super successful for him. Just like I said, racers were able to adapt and overcome any challenges. So I'm sure that's going to be a great venture for him moving forward.
Yeah, and Baker's Bash 2025, whenever it comes around, like I need to make sure to take PTO and get up there to Michigan for that race and support Brad and what he's doing. I remember the race that he was talking about with Sammy and Henry and seeing videos of that on the, I think, Flat Track Live Facebook page. That was an epic battle for sure. And Corey talks about on his podcast, we need more cushion racing, and I'd love to be able to get some more cushion tracks. I don't think I've ever been to any track except for Frederick.
Cushion tracks were always my favorite races to go to as a kid. I always looked forward to, at that point, the Mecca was Ohio. So whenever Dad and I were able to take a trip out to Ohio to race a cushion half mile against guys like Vander Coy, J.R. Addison, Jeffrey Lowry, it was a treat. It was a 7-hour road trip for us, leave Friday, get back late Sunday night, go to school on Monday. But they were the most fun, TTs and cushion half miles. Those are the most rider tracks, in my opinion. Skill is what shows on those rather than, getting in a blue groove half mile where you're kind of follow the leader on a cushion. You can spread it out. So yeah, Baker's Bash, I'm not sure how much I'm going to race moving forward, but Baker's Bash is probably going to be on my calendar.
Well, if nothing else, we'll go up there and support it for sure and then get everybody together. That's not too far for you. You'll have to figure out some flight stuff, but... So yeah, Baker's Bash, what Brad's doing, what Corey Texter does with Winter Throwdown and his Hagerstown race, the guys at RBA Flat Track, Mike Turner, John Nickens, Mike Hacker. It's just awesome to have, former riders and current riders with Mies as well doing events like that.
Yeah, just like you said, it's amazing what Brad's doing and Corey's doing with his events. And then I saw today that Michael Hill has actually started 47 Promotions. I saw that on Facebook, and it looks like he's putting on an event this December. So to have guys like that stepping up to the plate, Brad talked about how we'd lost some amazing promoters throughout the past. And now that we've got some of these younger guys putting on events, and the cool thing about racers doing it is we know what we want. We know what can be successful. We know how, what we've liked and what we haven't liked from previous events from other promoters. So hats off to those guys. Keep it coming. Keep working hard. And everybody that's listening to this, make sure you can get out there and support it. These guys need it. They don't have huge sponsor backings like the big series that we all follow, American Flat Track. So to support these little guys, get out there, do what you can, at least share the posts on Facebook. That's the minimum.
So obviously the next round on the American Flat Track schedule, we've got Springfield coming up, the doubleheader. Are you going to be, you mentioned that you're going to be heading up there, so you got any special plans for it?
Springfield's the first event where it's actually going to be really hard for me to be in the grandstands. I had to keep reminding myself, part of my retirement video was making sure that I would not come back, because once I retired, I was not going to come back and race. I didn't want to have that. And I talked to so many people and there's just some weird juju around doing that. So Springfield's going to be a really hard one. Me and LJ, my team owner, we discussed it like, you'll be ready for Springfield. I'm like, man, I would love to. Springfield, it's a track that's so much fun, and I've done really well there in the past, and I was really looking forward to it this year. I had a different bike to ride, so it's going to be tough for me. Hopefully I can get in the commentating booth and at least do that a little bit, but it's going to be fun. We're bringing out my camper, so we're going to do Springfield Mile as a, typical fan where you go and camp for the weekend in the campground, and I'm going to help my buddy on Thursday and Friday at the short track. We're going to see if we can put her in the main event. It's not been going well the past couple of years, but I think we've got a couple tips and tricks we've been testing, so we'll do that. And then Saturday and Sunday we'll be at the Springfield Mile, so it'll be great, a little weekend trip with my girlfriend, and it's only an hour and a half away, but it'll be really fun. I'm looking forward to it.
That will be a blast. My dad and I got to go to Springfield. It was my first time going last year, and it's a surreal place to go into and to walk through those gates and up into those stands as a fan. So you'll have a different perspective of it this year, for sure. But cool that you're going to be able to go up there for the whole weekend, do the double short track and the double mile.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And I wish we would have been able to meet last Springfield. We've never actually met in person yet. So one of these races, we will get together and we will do it. But I just want to reach out to all the fans and say thank you guys so much for the feedback. We want more feedback. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you're not liking, what we can do better. We're very dedicated to this podcast. We're working hard on it. Like I said earlier, it's just so much work. It's way more work than I thought, but the feedback makes it all worth it. It keeps me going. Those long nights where I'm editing, I've got a full-time job and editing this, and I'm trying to keep my personal life going. So I appreciate the feedback. It keeps me going. I'm working on getting a better artwork for the page. We're going to have our Facebook and Instagram pages coming up this week. And, if you can support that, like those pages, share them, share the podcast. It all goes a long ways.
Yeah, and absolutely. And if there's anybody that you would like to hear from, if there's guests that you'd like to have us chat with, throw those in the comment section or shoot us a message. Pages, we're always open to, reaching out and chatting with different people on here. Obviously, we're just getting started, so we've kind of got a wide open notebook of anybody to bring on. So let us know your suggestions in that as well.
And thank you, Scotty, like always. And thank you to the fans. That is the wrap up for the second lap of the Sideways podcast.